Ryan Stanton here with ASEP Frontline, and today's episode is a recording from a panel discussion I moderated this last week at Corporate Council 2022. This is with a gathering of emergency medicine and industry leaders to discuss opportunities for advancing emergency care and access to patients. And this conversation that we had was among and discussing the evolution of emergency medicine and the practice of medicine, much through COVID, but some of the changes that have taken place. And so we took time to discuss this 45 minutes, and we wanted to bring it to you here as a discussion point that we had there in Dallas, Texas.
So we are going to transition into our segment that's going to be focused on panel discussions. So as you know, emergency medicine is changing and continuing to evolve. For the specialty, especially with the pandemic. So we wanted to kind of have a conversation with our physicians that are in the field, talking about the current trends, explore opportunities, and what that means for our physicians today. So Dr. Stanton, and changing the EM landscape panel. We'll start now.
All right, panel, get on up here. I swear, Jody, I thought this was going to be virtual. So I prepared for such. Good Lord, this is almost embarrassing as getting your nose broken at bowling.
Still technically pants.
Short. They're short pants. Like the pants if you're short, shorts if you're tall. All right, so good morning, everybody. I'm Ryan Stanton, emergency physician. Like seeing a lot of folks out there that have been on my podcast before, some that have shoved tampons up my nose from random people at bowling alleys. Teleflex for offering me some quick clot so I didn't bleed to death. We all came together last night, and we're one team here, so I appreciate all that. And the conversation today, we have some of our leaders in emergency medicine. We want to talk about some of the change, you know, as I'd mentioned, as emergency medicine, but it's really everybody, two things we hate. It's change and then things staying the same. And so COVID really made us change quickly. It made us evolve. And we see that with crisis across the board, is when things happen that you have to accommodate, we end up with significant change. And some of that's good, some of that's a challenge, but I think, how do we make this the best product and the emergency medicine we want to see in the future? So joining me today up here on the panel, Dr. Angela Gardner, Dr. Ugo Ezinguel, Dr. Jeffrey Goodlow, and Dr. Teresa Tran. And what we're going to do is I'm first and foremost going to give them a few minutes to just introduce themselves, give them a little bit of background, and then we'll jump into the conversation. Now, we have some prepared questions that'll get some stimulus kind of going, but also we welcome questions. So if you have a question at any point, raise your hand or whatnot. We're going to try to have some time at the end as well to have some questions. I am sorry for my voice this morning. I am not sick. This is still the leftovers from trying to use Afrin to keep my nose from bleeding. So we're going to see how that goes. Either way, it's going to be entertaining. All right, so let's start off with Dr. Angela Gardner.
Thank you. I'm still laughing about that. I'm Angela Gardner. I have a long and unwieldy title, but basically I'm the Vice Chair of Emergency Medicine at UT Southwestern here in Dallas. We staff the largest single-site emergency department in the country, weighing in this year at 256,000 patient visits. We also staff the university's hospital, children's hospital, and a portion of the VA. So we're hopeful that we will be back up to pre-pandemic levels and touching 500,000 patient lives this year.
I would rather not hit anywhere close to that number, ever. All right, Dr. Ezinguel.
So good morning. I hope you can get to me. Okay, so thank you. And so I want to say that I am an ASEP Corporate Council virgin. This is my first meeting, but I'm happy to be here. I run an emergency department at Mount Sinai Health System, Mount Sinai, Queens, in New York. And it's a community academic practice. We have over about 70,000 visits. It is what it is. The demographics reflects a working class neighborhood in New York City. More importantly, I'm also the system vice chair for diversity, equity, and inclusion for the Mount Sinai Health System. And recently I took on the role as a chair for the inaugural Committee for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for the American College, and I'm happy to be here.
All right, Dr. Tran.
Hi, I'm Teresa Tran. I am the Associate Vice President for Population Health and Advocacy for the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston System. Our emergency physician group and our physician group in general is the largest servicer of care in the Southeast Texas region. I'm also the Associate Dean of the School of Public Health at UT, and I practice emergency medicine, I actually still do practice. I'm also a board member for EMF, and this is also my first time here at Council.
And last, but definitely not least, Dr. Goodlow.
Hi, my name's Jeff. I like to help people. I get the amazing privilege of being an emergency physician in both Tulsa and Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. I work with over 2,700 EMS professionals as a chief medical officer for our EMS system, about 20 agencies, fire departments, a shared ambulance service, and we get the incredible opportunity to help over about 250,000 people a year. It's a very busy EMS system. I also work full-time at the University of Oklahoma as one of the attending emergency physicians in the residency program there, and I think, like all of my panelists, still very much enjoy taking care of patients at the bedside on days in the emergency department, days being loosely defined as nights, weekends, holidays.
Everything else.
Yeah.
All right, so now you know the people. Now let's hear what they have to say. One of the things that has significantly evolved over time has been the engagement of how industry engages with physicians. We've seen some of the decreased access within our hospitals and clinics. We see some of the limitation altogether. And recently, within our board of directors, we've had conversations about that ethical engagement. How do we properly contact and interact with industry without the potential of bias or things that may not be best for our patients? You know, the goal being we want to learn, but we also want to do what's best and evidence-based for every one of our patients. So this is for Dr. Goodlow. And the way we're going to roll this through is we've got each of them will have a wheelhouse topic that they're going to knock out of the park. And then everybody else gets to comment as well. And then if you have any thoughts, just let us know or save it for the end. All right, so Dr. Goodlow, given today's current practice environment, what are the most respectful and appropriate ways for companies that we see here to stay connected with emergency physicians, building trust, balancing ethics, and reaching emergency physicians?
You know, John Maxwell is a widely regarded author, teacher, leader on the subject of leadership itself. And he was asked about his thoughts of business ethics. And his answer surprised most people. And he said, I'm not sure what you're talking about. And they said, well, John, I mean, clearly we're talking about, you know, the honesty, the integrity, the character that you bring to the business environment, your work relationships, and not anything in your personal life, just, you know, the work stuff. And he says, yeah, I'm not sure what you're talking about because there is no such thing as business ethics. There's just ethics. You have them or you don't. And so it's interesting, I think, the journey that many of us have taken in the last 2 to 3 years in particular. I vaguely remember being considered for a brief period of time a hero. I'm not sure that I wear that term, but there seemed to be some elevation of recognition and support in the community, and that seems to have faded. And now, I think we're back to the cynical, doctors make too much money, and are they really in it for patients, and are they on the take from companies? And, by the way, you and industry, of course, join us in evil doing and nefarious intent. And I find that ironic. I did bring my own ink pen today, so I don't have to take any, branded ink pen. But I am short of Post-it notes, and so if you have those, I will only accept the short stack only. If I get the tall stack, I might be selling my soul, and that would be inconvenient. And so I think what's important is that we are all here united by, I think, a greater sense than maybe we realize. My suspicion is not a one of you has an addiction to airport hotels and death ray heat, and yet you're all here. Why are you here? You don't have to go to medical school to help someone in an incredibly meaningful way at a moment in time that truly matters to them and their family and their loved ones and can make a tremendous impact on their future. You can do what you do representing the industry that you do. And you do that because you're about a mission bigger than yourself. If you could choose what you wanted to do today, you got a free day, nobody would know. Maybe you'd still be here, maybe you'd be doing something with your family, loved ones, whatever. But you're here. We see that, and we respect that, and we appreciate you so much for that. Give yourself that grace and recognition as well. And so in the process of connecting with emergency physicians, dare I say physicians in general, make sure that you're making that outreach reflect what it is at your core, and that is you're about a mission bigger than yourself, a mission bigger than the sale. And in some ways, why do we have the respect that we do for you in industry? In some ways, you actually have it tougher than us. As physicians, you do. I can provide the standard of care. I can provide a standard of care that each of these three physicians would look at me and they would say, Jeff, I didn't know you had it in you. And I would say, well, thanks for the confidence. But no, I mean, you would say, absolutely, standard of care, perfect care. And you know what? Maybe the patient doesn't survive, or maybe they doesn't do so well. I still got a job tomorrow. We recognize that business is tough. And sometimes when you don't make the sale, maybe you don't have a job tomorrow. But to me, the secret in that sale is when you reach out to physicians, pick your mechanism, text, phone, face-to-face, email, whatever the case may be. How can you help me help patients? When you say, what is it that I can do to get you in this product today, you've lost me. When you say, what is it in the space of fill in the blank, where your industry operates, that are challenges for you, that are unmet needs, that are things you're looking for answers, and can I help you with that? Now, in a day that is more full than I can ever fulfill before it starts, now you've got some time for me, because I respect where you're coming from, and it's that commonality.
All right, thoughts, Dr. Tran.
Yeah, I completely agree with Dr. Goodlow, and I would also add that in the beginning process, in the beginning of that relationship building process, I love to hear from somebody who's selling a product that they actually care about what it is that I need, so that they are not coming to me with a product, but rather they're coming to me with a solution for a question that I have. And so a much more palatable opening is, what is it that you need? And if your product or service fits that need, great. If it doesn't, then, you know, go back and figure out a way that it'll fit that need. But that's really what I will make time for.
Dr. Gardner.
So I'm a boomer, so I still like pens, but you know, that's a lost cause for the young people in the audience. I think one of the biggest challenges faced today is one of access. How do you get contact information for people that you want to contact? And I think ASAP, EMF, and all emergency physicians can do a better job of getting themselves out there. And I think we should think about some great area for people to link together, and I'm not suggesting any sort of corporate entity that currently exists.
All right, Dr. Zinkwell.
So yes, I'm going to echo a few things that have been said here. I think that the ethical pinnings of what we do is important to drive the care. You know, we sign up as emergency physicians to take care of the whole people, everyone that's out there. We don't really care who enters the doors of our emergency department. And so when we come to products that come from industry to us, I think it's important to recognize that we have communities out there that we want to reach out to. And we could talk a little bit more about it in my segment of the talk. It's important that whatever is brought to the table, that we recognize that we have to have and deliver equitable care to the patients that we serve, and likewise, we have to have a workforce that reflects the communities that we serve. So that's sort of my bent on it. It's like, really, when we go out there and we're planning and we're doing the research and development, we really have to be intentional with what we're doing and making sure that what products that we bring to bear reflect the communities that we want to take care of, and also reflect our overarching goal is to take care of anyone who walks through that door.
And I completely agree, and great comments. It really is about the relationships, personal relationships with us. That there's a lot of men and women in this room that I know personally and trust as a friend, and then those interactions we happen to be trying to find solutions to help us take care of patients. Because in the end, that's the goal, is how do we become better and more efficient at performing the job that we're asked to do every single day. And that's one thing that's nice about everyone sitting in this room, is that you're trying to bring us solutions to help us do the things that we're going to do. During this time also, and there was a little bit of a teaser right there with the mention of the pen by Dr. Gardner, over time, the methods of engagement have changed. And everybody in here is probably, most people are kind of in my age range, and we do a little bit of Facebook, maybe a little bit of Twitter. Dr. Tran here, she's going to knock out some Instagram, I'm sure, because we've already talked about it. But the methods of engagement. You know, the physicians that began this specialty when we went to medical school, and you learned by going to the medical library and actually checking out journals, physical hand-copied journals, and it goes online. And we've ended up with UpToDate, and then we have social media, and then we have podcasts, and then we have everything else. So we want to talk a little bit about how do we engage? How do we find the audience? Because the challenge is right now, we have docs that are in their 20s, and we have docs in their 70s, 80s, 90s, and apparently a neurologist or neurosurgeon who's 101. So how do we engage these differences in audiences? So Dr. Tran, what are some different mediums to learn and engage with physicians, knowing that your goal will determine the best way to reach those physicians?
All right, well, thanks for calling me out, but I'm not, I'm really not that young. And I don't have a TikTok. But, I'm going to start with just the basics, and some things will never ever change, especially for emergency physicians. The personal relationship and the teaching. We know that you are the experts in whatever you are selling or giving to us, and so we want to learn about it. I'd rather not be sold something, but rather be taught about it. And if it's going to be sold to me, it's going to be sold to me by my friends. I know that a huge medium and a place of learning nowadays, not just for my generation, but maybe for Dr. Goodloe as well, is emergency is actually Facebook. So we have a big group called EM Docs. Have y'all ever heard of it? So this is the biggest secret, not secret, of emergency physicians. There's 23, I think, and counting, thousand members of this group. And if one of my physician colleagues on there says that I've used this with success, it's going to generate conversation around it. It's going to generate questions and interest, and that's probably the best form of sales for a large group of physicians. That's actually free. So I think in social media. So we don't. By the way, I think that students nowadays do learn from Instagram, from videos, from interactive things. If you're going to have something online, it better be mobile friendly. I don't think that we like to memorize things anymore as part of an entitled generation. I'd rather just have the information at my fingertips. So with that being said, once we have a product in our emergency department, if you really want us to use it, create a dot phrase for our EMR. so that the information is there at my fingertips. Give me an infographic. I'm sure you learned in sales that you want to communicate on a fourth grade level to most people. When you're communicating to emergency physicians, you want to communicate like on the level of a squirrel. We want bullet points. We want facts. We want to the point information, and then that information to be sold to us by our colleagues and friends. Another area that will never change, I think, is the need for engagement with residencies and in medical students, with medical students, because they do tend to become the ones, even as an attending, they'll be the ones sometimes to offer a new therapy and that I didn't know about. And so you got to be careful, of course, I'm sure you know this, but if there's a way for you to do hands-on residency visits, sponsoring journal clubs, I've seen that, and giving your product to the group to allow them to play with it and interact with it, I think is a huge way of earning our trust as well.
Dr. Gardner.
So I'm not on Facebook anymore for political and conscientious reasons, but I do know that it is a huge group. There's also, by the same name, EM Docs, a blog still available that has regularly published content, so that is out there. My team at UT Southwestern has developed an app called Procedure RX. It is not monetized, it is free. You can find it on the App Store. We developed an app in order to make information available to our faculty and residents for procedures. So we have a checklist for deep sedation. We have now videos on how to do different procedures and how to train on different procedures, as well as the equipment that you need, etc. And we find that it's a great learning tool. It is true that in most of our ERs now with the EMR, you can actually get online and look up a video on some website if it's approved by the university or the company involved. But the app is on everybody's phone. Everybody has one. And you can actually look at how to do the procedure before you start or review the salient points. So for teaching, that really, really works well for us. I know that EMRA has the antibiotic guide and its extensions, and we actually use that very frequently as well, and ASEP has its own version of an app out there, which is in my folder for that. So there are lots of media out there available besides social media for people to engage.
Dr. Zinkwell.
Yes, so I will echo some of these sentiments that have been expressed here. You know, I'm also, you know, I'm one of those, you know, I am a professor of emergency medicine. It's taken me quite a while to realize that I don't really need a Twitter handle because I just don't have time to engage in social media. But, however, I do see that some of my colleagues, some of the more younger colleagues of mine, they do use social media. They use Facebook, so I concur that those are platforms that can use. But when we talk about educational content, there's things like micro-ED, which is, you know, ASEP has sort of helped with that, and the EMRA, like you mentioned. These platforms have helped to get educational activity around. And I think that as we build sort of communities, in my emergency department, we try to do things collectively and cohesively, and so we build platforms to do sort of LLSA and have community, you know, have the conversations amongst ourselves. So if we can sort of bring platforms or things that could bring communities, sort of smaller social groups together, I think that can actually sort of bring the message that you want to send out there. It's important to recognize that as, you know, traditional forms of media, in the past we used to all write textbook chapters, and I hate to say it, but I don't think people read textbook chapters anymore. But, you know, for some who do, that's great. But I think people are looking in bite-sized pieces of information that's delivered at the point of care. I know that platforms like UpToDate makes a big impact because it's right there on the EMR. And so as you have ideas and you're partnering with other industry leaders like Epic or Cerner, and these are EMRs that sort of drive the care at the point of care, I think that's where you can get the most benefit and impact.
All right, and Dr. Goodlow.
Yeah, so I think the panelists are spot on, and certainly to your point about textbook chapters, I think this applies to all of us. Having written some, I have to say I hope people are not reading them, because in the 2 to 3 year publication cycle, I've literally written textbook chapters that I would you know, dare say that what was, you know, 2 to 3 years ago standard of care no longer is. So I hope people are not reading anything I wrote in a textbook. But so for a 53-year-old, you know, 20-something year into it, emergency physician, you want to take a guess what my daily on-screen time is on my phone? Because yours tells you what yours is. Mine tells me mine is over 8 hours a day. 8 hours a day. For a 50-something-year-old guy, I never would have thought of that. So when you want to meet me in my office, where is my office? My office is my phone. Now, a lot of that is related to the emphasis I have in my practice on out-of-hospital medicine. And so I have this ticker tape of chaos and maladies across the state of Oklahoma. In fact, if you're at my table, if you could get my phone and delete anything that might be distressing while I've been up here, I would appreciate that for my own mental wellness. But I think back to Teresa's point exactly. You are the experts in your product and service lines. If you're not the expert, something's wrong with that equation, right? So you are the expert. Help us know what we don't know that we don't know about your product. And, you know, just in general, people often want the, hey, can we just meet for 15 minutes? You guys know, 15 minutes is never 15 minutes. 15 minutes becomes an hour. And so before I'll accept a, hey, let's actually block off some real time to have a real conversation, send me something that will catch my interest about your product. Help me know something that I didn't know I didn't know. And then if it fits the needs of taking care of patients, now we got time. Now we got something to talk about.
And with all of that, you know, later today, the opportunity to learn, part of the discussions coming up will be on like how the podcast works and why we make them, or why I make them 20 to 30 minutes. I mean, about 10 of you in here just glancing have been on the podcast so far. And the reason we do it the way we do it, and the messaging and the way we communicate, and the fact that we don't talk about a product, we talk about a disease and a process and something that we can help patients that relates to that product. So all of it's very intentional. And how do we engage? And how do we keep that interest? But also, during all this time, we've, with COVID-19, we've seen a significant evolution in the practice of medicine. We've seen the growth and explosion of telehealth, connecting to patients where they are. So I want to start off with Dr. Gardner here. What are the protocol process changes that are likely to be temporary or permanent that have occurred in recent years, whether it's Zoom meetings, whether it's the evolving point of contact with patients, telehealth, changing in access, or I think all of us have really dealt with recently the supply chain challenges and constantly shuffling how we practice medicine because of what we actually have available in our emergency departments. Dr. Gardner.
Thank you. I brought these with me this morning. These are two pennies. I realize most of you probably don't even carry change anymore or money of any type. But when I was president of ASAP 13 years ago, we had what we called the 2 cent campaign. And that was a campaign to let people know, especially our country's leaders, that 2 cents of the healthcare dollar were spent on emergency care. Because there was a perception that emergency medicine was so expensive and we need to cut pay to doctors and we need to cut reimbursements for ER visits, et cetera. And that perception lasted a very long time. Unfortunately, fortunately in that they weren't able to cut visits very much, but the pandemic has let Pandora's box remain open. And what we found out in 2020 was that people would elect not to come to the emergency department. And that hasn't been ignored in Washington. They know now that they can cut ED visits by as much as 80%. Now, the consequence of that has some early publication, and there will be more publication. More people died at home. More people had worsening of their illnesses and required more care, and that may cost more in the long run. And certainly there's a death toll associated with it, but I think that is a box that we cannot close again. And there are going to be consequences for that. And as leaders and as people involved in the profession, we need to think about down the road, where will we be with that? One of the fallouts that we'll talk about in the next panel, too, is the fact that this was a time that changed for emergency physicians in a fundamental way. When I got out of my residency 33 years ago, I could have walked into a job anywhere in the country except Seattle and San Diego and had a job that paid well and made me happy. I think our current residents can't say that. And certainly they're even worried if they can find a job in an emergency department or a traditional emergency department. And I think that will be a lasting change from the pandemic. On the bright side, though, there's still only 2 cents for every dollar spent on emergency care. And there is a focus now on what's happening in emergency care. We have to decide, as a specialty, whether this is good or bad. But we now screen for 18 things in the public health arena when a person comes into the ED. It takes longer than the traditional 5-minute triage. But right now, we have a whole screening panel for monkeypox. And we've not given up the screening panel for COVID. And we're still screening for Ebola here in Dallas. We're a little sensitive about that. And so we have 18 things that we screen for on every visit. If we take 30 seconds for an answer, that's a 20-minute triage, which puts us an hour before they see a doctor, and that isn't what we were designed for. I don't think that's going away. I think that will be a challenge for us as we go forward. And with every emerging disease, there will be more things that we have to screen for or deal with. The other part of that screening is that we're now offering immunizations for different things. I know that across the country it's been divided in whether people give COVID immunizations or not. Some people do it on-site, some people do it off-site, some people don't do it at all. But now that there is a monkeypox immunization, I understand that in New York some ERs are giving that immunization when it's available. So that's another part of our emerging practice that was not anticipated 33 years ago, that we would be the public health purveyors of the country. Some other things that are good that I think are here to stay. Zoom is actually a good thing, and now people know how to use it well, except Dr. Stanton, who confuses virtual with real. So Zoom is here to stay, and I think that's a good thing. It unites us across the country. It allowed those of us in this room to talk for a few minutes about what we were going to say on the panel. I do think telehealth is here to stay. It has had its challenges. The biggest challenge is you take someone that's Dr. Goodloe's age and you put him on his phone and you ask him to interact with his PCP who's on a computer in the office, and the interface is not always smooth. And the foundations don't always interact seamlessly in terms of the actual hardware that's involved. But overall, I think telehealth will be here to stay, and I think that's something that the federal government payers will have to deal with as well. I do think there are some changes in access. As we use more telehealth, we may be able to put more people in touch with their PCPs and not need to come to the ED, and also may be able to get their preventive treatment in a quicker and easier fashion. I do think that the emerging leaders in the specialty will have to deal with how to automate a few things that we didn't have to deal with as they mature into their specialties, but my crystal ball doesn't go far enough to see how far that will go. And as for supply chain, I'm unable to predict how the war that is being fought in the Ukraine will go. I'm unable to predict whether recession will affect our supplies. I'm unable to predict whether China's complete lockdown still of 54 counties or states in their provinces will affect supply chain. But I think that dealing with those supply chain issues is part of our future indefinitely.
Wonderful comments, and I do want to note that from the podium up, I'm all business today. Down below, I'm all Kentucky casual, and I am a believer, as a dad, that sliders and socks go together just fine. I mean, this is my comfort. I'm a dad. I'm not trying to impress anybody anymore, really. All right, so Dr. Ezekiel, comments.
So I do agree. I think the pandemic exposed a lot of things. Yes, there were inequalities of care, but also exposed the fact that we need to strengthen our public health infrastructures, and I think I do agree, Dr. Gardner, that that's not going away. The premise that the fact that we have to screen for all these patients coming in, for whatever these diseases out there, from Ebola to monkeypox to influenza to hepatitis C, HIV. We realize that as we go forward in the future, there's going to be a time when patients can actually do this on their own, even before hitting the emergency department. That's, you know, when we talk about practice innovation, that's where we're coming. And we're doing this already in New York, where on my way, patients are accessing telehealth services even before they arrive to the urgent cares and to the emergency department. So that's definitely not going that way. And that's actually a good thing. I think that as we talk about proliferation of broadband into communities that don't have it, so we can provide equitable access to this care, this is where we need to go, and I think it's a really important thing. So I think the public health pandemic did lay bare some of the inefficiencies we have in our system, but it also exposed the fact that we can do more and we can strengthen what we can provide for our patients. So that's I think, is a boon to what we expect for the future.
Dr. Goodloe.
Yeah, so I really appreciate Angela's always apt insights. You know, it's an old adage, right? The only constant is change. Maybe this is a type of change, but it feels the only constant today in emergency medicine is shortage. So the 8 to 10 days a month that I'm in the emergency department, it's a 38-bed emergency department with 6 hall beds that are usually filled for a 500-bed hospital. I can't tell you exactly how many beds we have upstairs, but I know it's less than 500 because we are functionally less than 500 because we are certainly short of nurses. There are days that I walk in a 38-bed ED with 6 hallway beds that I have 40 boarded patients. So before I even see someone that is new to me, hi, I'm Dr. Goodloe, what brings you in today, how can I help? I'm getting sign out from the night doc on 40 patients. That is not an overstatement. And then throughout the morning, where I'm single coverage as an attending, thank goodness I have some residents that are just the most enthusiastic, wonderful souls ever. And so they're scurrying about and I'm scurrying behind them to make sure everything is going according to plan. Then I successively find out what we're in shortage of that day. We don't have a calcium channel blocker that we typically use for tachydysrhythmias. So what's our on-the-fly beta blocker protocol? We don't have a sedative of rapid onset that we prefer for hyperactive delirium or other procedural sedation type needs. So what do we have? And do we even have anything in the emergency department? And is it coming from central pharmacy, which technically might be 300 yards down the hallway, but that equates to about an hour, it seems like, before something actually comes. So it is a constant struggle, and yet both blessing and perhaps burden in some ways. I am reminded, growing up as a small child, my dad was a family physician, never took appointments, call him 24 hours a day if you're sick, and every so often he would say on the phone, this one I think you ought to just go to the emergency department. And as I became an emergency physician, I would say, Dad, how many people are you sending to the ED? He goes, well, just one tonight. Okay, how many family physicians are there in some area, right? Just one here, just two here. And so it is an amazing blessing to have the trust of the medical community. If you want something done, if you want your patient seen and relatively rapidly evaluated, where do you send them? You don't send them upstairs, you send them to us in the emergency department. But we are doing that more and more and more with less and less and less. That is a significant challenge.
Dr. Tran.
Thank you. I think back on what practice looked like before and after the pandemic and my own personal feelings and the feelings of my residents, my coworkers. And I think that we all know that the pandemic both elevated our position in society, I think, and also burned us out. And I think it created residents who are scrappy, gritty, and strong, but it also created physicians who when I graduated from residency, I was told that I'd probably change my career every 5 years. And now we see physicians who burn out after 1 or 2 years and want to change after 1 to 2 years. And this is a problem, but I think also an opportunity for physicians to actually look for and elevate what they love and what they're passionate about. I think after the pandemic, it became more important to value what actually brought us into emergency medicine. And in any way that you can help to promote that sentiment, it helps, I think it helps physicians continue to do what they're doing and to find a place where they're truly passionate.
All right, so we've got about 6 minutes left, 7 minutes left. We want to try to keep everybody on time, but absolutely want to get to this last topic and give the full time necessary to Dr. Ezinkwell. You know, as most people know, our documentation changes significantly in 23. We're going to find out sometime, probably August or September, what the rules are going to be, and then we all have to learn the rules on how they're going to change. But it really boils down to the four Ds: the differential diagnosis, what are you doing about it, who you're discussing it, discussing with, and the determinants of health, which is a huge upgrade of what are the things, the challenges we're going to try to bridge with our patients, whether it's food insecurity, housing insecurity, medications, whatever it may be. And so I want to pose this to Dr. Ezinkwell. So the changes in documentation, awareness of what's on the front lines and advocating for our higher risk patients. So how do we bridge the gaps with our higher risk patients? Potentially, how does industry help us meet the need, ensure access with limited funds to our patients, ensure the vulnerable get access to the needs, ensure compliance for the drugs? And just for an example, yesterday, my 16-year-old nephew, he was recently admitted for strep meningitis. And outpatient afterwards, in the line, he's got developed a DVT. And so starting on a NOAC. And weren't aware of the programs and challenges. And so initially, we're not going to get the medicine because of the cost. And so, thankfully, you know, my wife's a physician as well, working with them, awareness of the programs and things to help them get the medications they need. So how do we bridge those gaps to ensure that the patients we see who may not have the system literacy that the physicians have or the others in the healthcare system have, how do we ensure that we bridge that gap to make sure they are getting what they need to get the best outcomes possible?
So thank you, Ryan. So, you know, that's a several questions, very important questions. I think this is something that we've all have challenges to. I think I'm going to take it back a little bit more before we start discussing social determinants of health. You know, as emergency physicians, and I'm sure as folks in industry, when you first sign up to do this work, we sign up to be physicians to take care of our patients. One of the premises we said is we have to sort of deliver care that comes in. Anything that comes in through our doors, we're going to deliver care that means it's equitable. And what does that really mean? It really means delivering quality emergency care and within the accepted standards of care to all types of patients, regardless of where they live in the geographic, you know, we're talking urban versus rural. We just had a conversation during breakfast. Folks in North Carolina, you have the bottom of North Carolina has all the health systems, and then the top is like nothing. So if you, God forbid, something happened to you and you happen to live up top, you have a hard time getting to a health system in the bottom part. But we also talk about race, black versus white. We also talk about age, older versus younger. We can talk about gender, male versus female. We can talk about just sort of your demographics, your in a geographic location, your religion, your politics. Who knows what it is that drives you as a human being? But the reality is we want to be able to deliver care that's sort of, when you walk through those doors, you're getting the same care regardless of what you look like, who you are. So that's the premise, right? And so the question is, how can we do that knowing that we have significant challenges in what's out there? You know, the Institute of Medicine nearly 20 years ago came up with that report in 2003 about unequal health disparities in care. And I will tell you that nearly 20 years later, we're still struggling as health systems, as hospitals, as industry, to try to meet the needs of how we take care of our colleagues and patients out there. it is amazing and fascinating to me that America sort of drives technology. And those of you in industry, you have some remarkable achievements in the care and the sort of the innovation that drives the quality of the care we deliver. But yet, the reality is that there's limited access, such that we still struggle with maternal mortality as a whole. We still struggle with infant mortality. And patients coming to the emergency department are not different anywhere. We have to deliver the better cares, and we have to be intentional on the care that we deliver, right? And so when we are in our backgrounds or sort of boardrooms or in our hospital administrative offices or in emergency departments, and we're making decisions, we have to be intentional about what is the purpose behind that decision. Paul Badalin, who was just the founder of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, he said that systems are designed perfectly to get the results that they're designed for, right? So you design a system, what results you get. Our healthcare system has been designed to get this result that we have, and let's be clear on that. And so we have to be intentional in changing the system from its core. We have to define our purpose as we go forward. What is it that drives us as an industry, and what drives us as a professional organization like ASAP? We have to recognize who the people we're serving are, what communities, and in the pandemic sort of laid that bare, right? We recognize that certain communities didn't have the same accesses, and consequently, the morbidity and mortality was higher in those communities. We have to look at the processes that we build. How are we intentionally making sure that those processes touch the specific communities that we want them to be and want them to go? And then the place that we deliver the care. So in emergency medicine, we think of the emergency department as being it. But again, the pandemic has shown us that no, we have to now go out of scene. We got to use telehealth services to meet our patients where they are. In New York, in my institution, we just started hospital at home. So we're now sending patients who qualify for it, that they're now getting their hospitalization in the comfort of their homes, using teleservices where you have a doc who's seeing them and a nurse who comes by to see them. Market innovation, well, the question is who is actually getting access to that, and so we have to do better. I think about a pharmaceutical company out there who designed an agent, an antimicrobial agent that's given as a one-time dose, and it has a bioavailability over 7 days. So one-time dose in the emergency department, and then you're out, and guess what? You don't have to take medications twice a day, four times a day. You don't have to go to the pharmacy. You're done. That's the innovation we need, and that's the medications, the therapeutics that emergency physicians will sign on. It's a no-brainer. You bring that to my emergency department, I see that I can give it to patients who may otherwise not have access to it, and they're done, and I could send them home. That's the sort of the care and innovation that we need. And so as we think about this, the social determinants of health, what drives our patients, right? Access to care, the social structure, the socioeconomics, these are real questions. I think a lot of EPs are starting to ask those questions because it can't be care as usual. The fact that I know that my patient doesn't have access and I say follow up with your PCP or follow up with your specialist when I know that the next appointment is literally 4 or 5 months down the line, that I know is I'm doing a disservice to my patient, but that's what happens. And so we have to build better systems, and I think that as social determinants of health will drive the question, I think a lot of folks are recognizing that in their differential, they have to take into account the fact, what is the patient's status like at home, and how do they get the access to the care that they really deserve? And that's a challenge for all of us. The Institute of Medicine's report 20 years ago, there's disparities in care that's been going on for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. It's not going to go, and it's not going to be solved overnight, but we have to take that challenge, and we have to hit that part, the button, the reset button, and then maybe we can make a change and an inroad in this. So thank you for those questions. I know I didn't hit the specific bullets because I don't have all the answers, but we can collaborate and come up to some solutions that make sense. Thank you.
Thank you. We're coming up on time. You know, the key take-home message is that the goal are the partnerships for which we can do better for each and every one of our patients. We can evaluate them. A lot of the industry in here are emergency physicians as well. And we can do a lot for our patients, but then can we meet that plan? Can we make that plan happen? Because we're looking for the best quality of life, the best outcomes we can for each and every person that comes through our doors. And as we focus, I mean, we are the safety net for each of our communities. I always like to say from the beginning that we're the barometer of our system. We, the emergency department, lets you know what's going on in your community. And so how can we face those challenges better for each and every patient as we move forward. So I want to thank each of our panelists here. Catch them as you go out. If you've got questions or whatnot, you want to expand on any of these conversations. And we have more coming up, and I appreciate it. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for everybody being here, especially thank those that came to the call of need last night when we had our first doc down. So appreciate it. Thank you. Enjoy your time. Have a good day.
That wraps up a panel discussion from Corporate Counsel 2022 from Dallas, Texas, and I appreciate you tuning in. You can contact me, rstanton@asep.org, rstanton@asep.org, or at Everyday Med on Twitter. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASEP Frontline.
If you're not on the front lines, you're on the sidelines.